Hi, friend. It's Brittany Moses.
And Ranella Kalagithi.
And you're listening to Speaking Our Minds, the podcast that brings you honest and nuanced conversations around mental health, holistic wellness, and the real complexities of what it means to be human in the challenges of today's world, where we have fun, fascinating, and meaningful discussions around how to live a more insightful, connected, and whole life from the inside out, joined by guest professionals, thought leaders, and some of my friends and those with lived experience. As always, we ask that you keep in mind that the views and opinions shared here are respectively held by each individual and is not a substitute for professional care or an alternative to seeking personal help from your clinician or provider and is ours to discern. We're so glad you're here. Follow the conversation on Instagram at Speaking Our Minds Pod and sit with us because we're diving in.
Welcome back to another episode of Speaking Our Minds. This is Ranella.
And Brittany.
And we are here. We are excited to share.
We showed up another day.
We showed up. We're, you know, just living our lives, having the best conversations before we even go on air, which we should probably record in the future. But today we are talking about something that's so near and dear to our hearts because it is a huge part of our own lives, and that is deconstructing patriarchy and its effects on our mental health.
Oh, that sounds loaded.
Yeah, because there's just so much that we're learning, that society is learning. Sometimes these words can be trigger words for people. Patriarchy, feminism, woman, you know, being a womanist, like all of these words. So I'm really grateful for Brittany because she kind of, her brain, the way her brain works is she kind of comes with like the more clinical side of things. And she loves sharing all the data and research, which I always love hearing. And I come from a strongly counseling psychology background. So we'll be kind of weaving that in today. But Brittany has some incredible like background research she's done on this topic.
Thank you. I just love us. And yeah, I'm really into like the social construction of like the social psychology of how things have come into the world as we're experiencing it today and reality as we're experiencing it. And I think when we're talking about, you know, a construct like patriarchy, that's huge, you know, in kind of the world of social constructionism. It's this idea that we take for granted that like the knowledge that we have and the reality that we live in as being automatic, as being the norm, when really these realities have been socially constructed over time through history by people.
Right.
So this month, I know we decided we were going to talk a little bit more just about womanhood and, you know, things like how patriarchy affects not just women, but also men. And for those who aren't familiar kind of with the background of patriarchy, you know, when we say that a society is socially constructed by something like patriarchy, we mean that the organization, the norms, the values, the power dynamics within society are not actually inherent, but were at some point created and maintained by people in institutions, especially those with, you know, the upper hand or in power. And not only this, but they're culturally maintained and reinforced through things like family and upbringing, right? Parents play a formative role in the indoctrination of gender roles and expectations. Things like language and narratives we're using, media, institutional structures like government and legal frameworks, laws, religious institutions, and ultimately those with higher decision-making power. So that's kind of, I think what I wanted to start with is this idea that social structures are not only brought into existence, usually for some original necessity, but they are perpetuated and reinforced over time through systems.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And I think, you know, when we all kind of stop to think about our backgrounds and upbringings, did anyone come to that point in their lives, maybe when they were like 12 or 13 or in their teenage years, where all of a sudden their little bubble was broken and they realized their parents weren't perfect. I think that when you're really small, when you're young, your whole world is just perfect. You feel like everything is the way it should be. As you get older, you get exposed to more. And some people start recognizing developmentally that the world that they've been living in is completely constructed. Some people learn that much later in life than others, and some never learn that. Like everything that they know and believe, you know, religiously, politically, or whatever, like their reality is right 100%. Does that make sense? Like
Oh yeah.
we, you know, like there comes a point, and hopefully by the time you're in your 20s and 30s, like that's why when you go to college, you're exposed to other people's brains and experiences. And the more people you meet from different backgrounds and walks of life, the more holistic your experience is, because you realize that your reality has been almost completely constructed. And I think that's when you move into this different stage of development where you are able to hold space for the fact that things, ideas, beliefs, have been just passed down over generations, and that maybe there is a different way to think about life. And so I'm really grateful that we're kind of deconstructing patriarchy, because it's 1000%, especially if you live in Western America, which we do. You know, in other countries, it's actually not as much so. They've maybe been on this journey for longer than we have, but we still live very much in a patriarchal society where we are uncomfortable with women leaders, and we still have ingrained ideas about women and other, you know, minority groups. So anyway, let's dive into what patriarchy is.
Yeah, it's so interesting because I hear you say all of that, and I feel like so much of it is a protective factor. Like you kind of want to have hope and feel like the world that you live in is perfect and is safe, and reality is, just easy, in terms of thinking one way about it. And so sometimes we might even internalize some of these ideologies like patriarchy, because it's just safer for us to kind of go with the flow of the system or the way things are, rather than buck against it, which could kind of cause maybe us some mental distress or some environmental stressors. I like to say it's a beautiful day to wake up and smash the patriarchy. So it's always beautiful day to wake up and smash the patriarchy. So what is patriarchy? Well, it's actually derived from the Greek word patriarchs. Patriarchy literally means the rule of the father, and it's used to refer to a social system where men control a disproportionately large share of social, economic, political, and religious power, and inheritance usually passes down the male line. Renowned American sociologist Alan Johnson talks about how patriarchy doesn't refer to any man or collection of men, but to a society in which men and women participate, where it is patriarchal to the degree that it promotes male privilege by being male dominated, male identified, and male centered. It's also organized around obsession with kind of control and involves one of its key aspects in the oppression of women. And I think when we're thinking about social construction, I kind of, if you like Jane Austen, her character Anne Elliot would say, men have had every advantage of us in telling their own story. Education has been theirs in so much to a higher degree. The pen has been in their hand, right, throughout history. So part of patriarchy's power is its capacity to make itself as invisible as possible and to not draw attention to how it's endured this way for so long. Right.
I think, you know, it if you are a man listening to this, like I hope
Hi.
that hi, I hope that, you know, kind of the mindset or the posture towards this is a posture of openness, even for women as well, because this is just history. And whoever holds the power, you know, holds the pen and writes the history and writes the perspectives. And I'm really grateful that we live in a world where we can just like sit on a podcast and talk about smashing the patriarchy and know that there are both men and women that are totally open and on board to like deconstructing this. And I guess taking kind of a little bit of a personalized detour, what are some ways, maybe we can share some ways that patriarchy has kind of affected our own mental health, but also just in general can affect the mental health of both men and women. Because I think that making this as practical as possible right from the get-go might be able to help people relate. Because like you said, it does affect both men and women. But I know for myself that I was not aware of this construct of patriarchy until actually probably about 5 or 7 years ago. So it's still fairly new for me. And I grew up, as many of you have heard in past episodes, I grew up in a Christian environment, which also lends itself to patriarchal ideologies, just historically, not across the board, not everywhere, but in general. And also having grown up Indian, Asian, in America, and especially in a subculture of a Christian denomination that was very patriarchal. I grew up reading the books that would help me be a more submissive wife. So that's probably why all of this really burns strongly in my bones, is I've directly been affected by the issues of patriarchy. And I grew up kind of in a world of white men, just to be frank. I didn't realize until I was in my late 20s how much of a fear of the white man I had, and simultaneously how skilled I was I guess making like pleasing men. And I'm not and I'm just talking about in every single way possible, as far as just like who I needed to be as a woman, what I needed to say,
Like
how I
staying
needed
in
to
your
act,
place.
staying in my place. I mean, I just knew how to be in the lane of a woman who is completely caught up in patriarchy without realizing it. And so I used to like practice being silent, and I would feel bad about sharing my opinions. I remember there was a time I really wanted to get my master's in leadership and communication, and I was told by a white male that it would be hard for me to find a husband if I had that degree. I have been praised by men my whole life for being in that role, and I've been put in positions where I'm a leader by both men and women, to be an example to other girls as far as how a woman should act. And so there's still these ingrained parts of me, that, I've realized are I just had to, I mean, that was my identity almost as well. So that was a part of my identity I had to deconstruct. And the issue, though, was that what it led to and what it made me feel on a day-to-day basis is that it, definitely affected my self-esteem and my self-worth, the need to people please, especially towards men, a lack of self-respect. I basically took whatever a man would say, and I would be like, yeah, well, that sounds right. He's a guy and I'm emotional and I can't be
Oh my gosh.
trusted. So there's a lot of like lack of self-trust. There's a lot of invalidation of my own emotions. I would make fun of myself and other women without realizing it. This is in like in my 20s when I was deep in that world where it was like, saying self-deprecating things about how, women are emotional and how, I mean, just so many things that I can think of that were just really affecting me. And it would affect me in my relationships as well. And so in my relationships, I didn't have a voice to speak up for myself. And Not to say that I was at all like abused or wounded by the men I was with, but there was definitely that air of like, oh, he's the head of the household. He's the spiritual leader. And no matter what, if it comes to a point where you are both disagreeing on something, you have to defer to him, which is such an interesting way of thinking, you know, like hopefully you are with someone you really respect, but I mean, it's two people that are equals that have like, you know, whoever just has the most experience in that situation, you know, should make the decision. Yeah. But anyway, so it definitely affected me a lot. And I think I didn't realize it until I came out of it. And that's when I had to face myself and face my low self-esteem and face the ways in which I didn't feel good enough and how I was centering my whole life around pleasing the people around me, but particularly men.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You're highlighting so many things here. Like also, yeah, in my own life, but you're highlighting like common narratives that are set. That are even said jokingly that kind of dehumanize and strip down women's capabilities and women's image. And right. also you're talking about like that reinforcement piece of how there's the indoctrination of the different books that you're reading by men, but then also it's reinforced by, you know, the men around you and the culture around you. So this is all working together in a system. And when you are in a closed network and in a closed system, then you're just going to internalize all of those things as reality and as the only true reality to defer to. But it's true. I completely relate to you because I too feel like there was so much that I just internalized as like, this is just truth, you know? And then once you come out of it, you're like, oh man, this is like, so damaging and detrimental to the female image. Like, and I don't mean like just physically, I mean just like internally, you know, in so many ways. And so one of my favorite quotes in the words of Gloria Steinem is, "The truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off." And that's kind of how I felt, you know, once I started realizing all the ways in which these systems are constructed and they internally affect your life and your self-image and your worth and all of that. You're just like, oh, it's gotta go. But that being said, you know, just some of the ways that these patriarchal attitudes and assumptions affect mental health, right? So it often imposes like rigid gender roles and expectations on both men and women prescribed to specific behaviors and characteristics based on their gender. Like you being told like, oh, you know, if you become a leader or you get this degree, then like,
right,
you're gonna have a hard time getting married, right? Like that's
just, it was that's not that was women. Always weaponized. The married part was always weaponized. It's like they won't like that. You won't get married, as if being unmarried and never, you know, finding someone was just the absolute worst thing that could happen to a woman. Like, oh, you'd be like stripped of your happiness forever.
Right. And now you realize like, oh no, then you're just with the wrong person because like a secure individual would not be threatened by your voice or your, you know, leadership, what you have to offer, your skills. Right. I think that says more about maybe the individual than you. But yeah, you know, these kinds of expectations can put pressure on both men and women to conform to unrealistic standards. And this can lead to stress and anxiety and low self-esteem. So when we say patriarchy hurts both men and women, this is what we're talking about, right? It doesn't give men the full expression or allowance for the fullness of their identity to have, you know, qualities across the spectrum to express, you know, emotions such as sadness instead of being categorized as weakness, or to have that nurturing quality that's not seen as just being effeminate, or, you know, all of those things. And same for women, like if she is more of a leader, if she does have more of a voice, that being cast as being something negative or threatening or bitter or whatever it is, you know, these terms. And so when people are stuck in these roles that A, feel like don't fit them or don't feel like don't fit who they truly are and they're conforming their lives around this type of suppression, yeah, it leads to these, it leads to this internalized stress and anxiety, you know, but also thinking about sexual objectification and harassment. We just did a whole episode on purity culture with Ranella and how patriarchal attitudes kind of can get intertwined into that. And that's that in patriarchal cultures, there tends to be an objectification and sexualization of women's bodies leading to experiences of sexual harassment, assault, and violence. And these types of traumas happen so commonly that can have profound and long-lasting effects on mental health, like PTSD, depression, and anxiety. So when we're talking about, you know, stress, low self-esteem, anxiety, depression, PTSD, these things aren't isolated experiences, right? We have to consider that some of this is actually an internalized result of the systems that we're in that are leading to these consequences. And that's why we have to talk about it, because along the way, it just doesn't bear good fruit, you know,
right.
And specifically for women.
Yeah. And when you were talking about sexual objectification, when you think about the idea that, you know, men are dominant, they're the leaders, they're more capable, you know, and women have this specific role in society, a huge role that women have, quote unquote, a role that they have is procreation, you know, reproduction.
Yes.
The pleasure of men, you know, like they're an accessory, they're there to support men and for men who do not see women as this holistic, all-encompassing, you know, human that can do anything a man can do as well. You know, we're obviously different biologically and, you know, in all genders in between, but like it totally makes sense that there is that sexual objectification, because there is such they place such a difference between men and women based on their sexuality and based on women playing this specific role. And just kind of a very, you know, very practical way that I felt that in kind of a weird, twisted way, was how modest I felt like I had to be, right? So I'm coming from a Christian background, Christian perspective, and this is not just Christian, it can be in other religions, or, you know, where the woman is expected to dress a certain way for the sake of the other. And that obviously puts so much pressure on the woman and also kind of paints her as this object and this object of temptation. And if that's not over-sexualizing someone or objectifying them, then I don't know what is. Like for me, I was always concerned about how low my shirts were, or like how short my shorts were, or if I was showing any arms, you know, like I would literally ask like my boyfriend, like, is this shirt high enough? Like, or should I put an undershirt underneath? Like to be having to think about that. And some people here won't really relate with that, but others of you will that grew up in that environment. And it is subconsciously, it really does make you feel dirty. And yeah, it makes you feel like an object, and it makes you wonder, how do men think of me? And it makes you feel responsible for it, which yes, definitely is not healthy. It doesn't allow you to develop a healthy sense of sexuality, and it does not allow men to develop a healthy sense of sexuality when they've been told that women are the problem, and yeah, that the way they dress, you know, like Jezebel or something, is, you know, the reason why they are struggling with their sexuality, whereas it's a totally different experience.
Oh my gosh, when you say the word like responsibility, I felt that so much. And again, it's this subconscious feeling that's constantly on the periphery of your life that makes you constantly self-conscious of your existence, of your body, of how you are showing up in the world. You constantly have this self-consciousness and this policing of yourself and of your body for like just existing as a woman that is internalized. For me, growing up, I was always bustier, because and I'm a small girl, so I was always bustier. So for me, like, I felt like just because of the natural makeup of my body, I had to be like extra on guard. Like, I definitely couldn't wear shirts that other women could wear, or something that I'd wear might automatically be seen as a temptation or voluptuous just because of the shape of my body. And I know a lot of women go through this, especially maybe if they are curvier or what have you, right? They're just existing in their bodies. They're not trying to tempt anyone, but because, maybe having certain features or being curvy or whatever is so sexualized, then the women become at fault for not policing their bodies accordingly, when literally they're just trying to exist comfortably, like in a body that they can't help. Like, I could not help my development, And so, but you are always on guard about that in your mind, this idea that you are responsible for the sexuality of all men. Like, who can carry that? Like, no matter where you go, you are constantly in responsibility of that, instead of holding men and others responsible for their own thoughts and actions, and putting more education and narratives toward the idea of the way that bodies naturally are, and not sexualizing them, So I, when you said that, that's something I totally relate to. I think it's okay to highlight that there are male and female differences, like you said, but without coming to the conclusion that this makes one better or superior or more capable or more insightful than the other, but that both have strengths to offer to the world that are equally valuable. I love what you said about roles, because in my marriage, that's exactly how we operate. Whoever kind of might take the lead on something between me and Jason is dependent on who has the more experience, who has the more expertise, or who is more naturally skilled or gifted in that area. Like, that's how we operate. It's not based on gender. It's like, if he knows more about something, I trust in his leadership. If I know it and have experienced something more, he trusts in mine. We're both full functioning adults, and that's been so helpful for us. And so, leadership is more than physical strength, violence, domination, or brute force, as our like historical culture would have it told. When we value these qualities as more superior, we get a society that reflects that, that is led with strength, violence, domination, and force. But leadership is also integrity, hope, wisdom, insight, thoughtfulness, dedication, resilience, decisiveness, right? And these qualities are not gender-based. Like, both men and women can exhibit those. And so, yeah, it's like, what do we want our society to reflect? That's the type of leadership we want to reflect. And yeah, that's, yeah.
There's just so much there. And maybe we can kind of go through a little bit more of the history of all of this before we jump into kind of the unhealthy, kind of toxic parts of patriarchy and masculinity. And just in general, I think one thing that's important to note as well is that coming from, when we're talking about couples especially, there isn't strong evidence that couples who conform to more of a type of relationship where, the woman has her role and the man has his role and they're a little bit more traditional, like that, those are in like worse relationships, but really it's about two individuals who respect one another and have the expectations that are on the same page based on mutual understanding and acceptance, versus one person who kind of sets those ground rules and says, this is how it's going to be. And the other person subscribing to a construct that maybe they don't fully align with, but they feel tied to. And so I think that's why it's important to talk about this, so women know their options and women know that there are men out there and vice versa that really subscribe to more of a just an equal partnership.
I love that you said that because it's just about like everyone has different wants and needs. And it's like if you do want a more traditional marriage where those are the structures in place, then find someone who's on the same page as you. And if you want more of something that's equal, that's definitely a conversation to have because this is your life.
Right.
I think really briefly, when thinking about the history and social construction of patriarchy, right? Like, where does this even come from? Because these are systems that we are born into. It's believed that patriarchy is a social system that came into being approximately 10 to 12,000 years ago. So, contrary to common belief, research shows that actually patriarchy isn't like a natural order of things. It wasn't always that way, that these hunter-gatherer communities actually may have been relatively egalitarian. And also female leaders and matriarchal societies have always existed too, especially in a lot of indigenous communities. But according to anthropologist Sarah Hardy at University of California at Davis, although we have been hunter-gatherers in our past, patrilocal residence, meaning that you only lived with, the husband or resided your life to the husband, was actually not the norm among modern hunter-gatherer societies. There was actually a degree of egalitarianism built into these systems where women in those early societies would have had the choice of support from the group they grew up with or the option to move away from oppression. So we weren't always, didn't always have an unequal system. And Dr. Gerda Lerner, who's a historian and professor who researches and examines the roots of patriarchy, believes that, patriarchy wasn't like some evil conspiracy of men, but really a system created by men and women, with unforeseeable consequences. So, there was a time when a woman's average lifespan may have been, maybe less than 28 years, and when infant mortality was like 70 to 75%, and women were spending a lot of time bearing and nursing babies all the time, in order for the tribe to survive. So there was a sexual division of labor that was created, for functionality, and that was approved of by both men and women. There was a biological basis for this division of labor. But what came to be was this oppressive part of that division, which is a social invention. So Dr. Lerner views the establishment of patriarchy as a historical process that developed 3100 BC to 600 BC in the Near East, where it arose partly from the practices of intertribal exchanges for women for marriage, where women would be like acquiesced because it was functional for the tribe. And these exchanges would uproot young women and gave them the notion that men had rights that women did not. And she contends that because of several factors, including the domination of warlike tribes over egalitarian societies lacking warriors, and women and children became the first prisoners and ultimately the first slaves in an era when male prisoners were killed. And actually, this, slavery of women and exploitation of their sexual and reproductive capacities by conquering men, marked the initial development of class distinction, that they were the first property in these societies, women and children.
It's interesting.
And it's the subordination of women that became the basis for class distinctions and the concept of property itself that eventually led to the idea of men's enslavement and just enslaving people. So patriarchy is not based on the biological differences between men and women, but as Dr. Lerner would say, it's on a stage of human development where women had to nurse babies all the time, and basically early in these societies, they needed people to be available to produce a surplus of resources and to be able to defend the state and even give up their lives if needed in times of war. Also, we're thinking they had to maintain population levels, and this put pressure on families where women were expected to focus on having more babies, and especially sons who would grow up and fight. Again, we're seeing historically there was a functional need for women to maintain the population, to continue to reproduce, and also birth males who could help defend, you know, the state, and men to spend time kind of giving their lives as women were birthing and, you know, protecting resources and what have you. That was agreed upon by both men and women for that functionality, but eventually became a social construction of male superiority over women, the trade of women and what have you as property.
Yeah, that is so interesting, because obviously this is, you know, we're all human. And so what started as like necessity kind of morphed into more of that social construct. And I think in general, women, you know, there's so much we don't know in history that is not in the books that I'm sure exists as far as, you know, dating back even further. Just with the idea of when you look at a woman, she is typically smaller. She is typically weaker.
Right.
She obviously is the only gender that can give birth and breastfeed. And like, there is like, I think for people who think about, you know, patriarchy and gender roles and everything, I can see how it's easy for people to look at it and say, well, there's a very clear role that women have. And I think the issue is not with the role and with, you know, what we're born with, and the fact that, you know, obviously there are hormones and there's all a physiological process that we all, you know, are programmed with and go through that we cannot deny and we cannot give up, and many of us don't want to, but that is not the issue. The issue is with the social construct that comes with it, with the attached meanings and beliefs about women over time, where women are, this is their role and they can't do other things, or they're less fit to do other things. And quite honestly, we just live in a different society as the hunter and gatherers,
all of
society is just so different right now. And in our very postmodern world, there's so many ways in which women can do more and are allowed to do more and are allowed to kind of explore now those parts of ourselves that we weren't able to in the past. And I think it is very natural for there to be all of this kickback. And it's also very natural for, you know, new generations, younger generations of men to grow up in this present world thinking, well, what's the issue? You know, like women can do anything men can do. And now, you know, they grew up in a world where we're talking more about women's empowerment. And so there's, you know, this sense that maybe like all is equal in the world. But when you look at this history and when you actually put the pieces together and realize that women have always been the slaves, women have they were always the first slaves. They were the slaves of men. They were, you know, taken into captivity. They always, because they had this role that did not allow them to be out, you know, doing other things. I mean, sure, would I rather stay home and nurse babies and, you know, take care of kids
than go
fight in war? Probably. But we don't live in that world right now. You know, in some ways we do, absolutely. And in many ways.
But why do we have war? Because of patriarchy. But anyway.
Exactly. Oh, yes, exactly. And
it
so
it comes back around.
It's so true. Like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? But yeah, that's just all so interesting. I think it's really important to get that history and to understand where it all came from. Because it's what we're trying to deconstruct is not, oh, that, you know, lamenting women and their role, it's and you know, their what they do in society, as far as giving birth and all of that, but it's really the social constructs that are just ludicrous, that are absolutely ludicrous, Because actually, there are more studies that show now that because women are so relational and so nurturing, they do make for better leaders in general, which is kind of amazing and incredible. But yeah, I thank you so much for sharing all of that. That's so interesting.
I mean, yeah, that's the big question into modern times, right? It's why did this construct exist? What was the purpose? Why was it perpetuated? Who did it serve that would continue to perpetuate this? What are the hierarchies that it would keep in place? You know, and does it really serve those same necessities today? Like you said, we are overpopulated. Like the world is overpopulated. So we no longer are in a place where it's like, we need to maintain the population. So, you know, that needs to be women's only role. Like, you know, this was an agreement in early history between men and women for the sake of the birth of humanity. You know what I mean? And, and that's where that social construct came out of a necessity. And we don't have those same necessities today. And so I think it's going to be up to people, and this is going to be a matter of opinion, to parse out, do we view the world this way because we believe it's the natural order of things, or do we view it this way because it came from a social construction, from a necessity that we once had that was then assumed and integrated to be told as a natural order to fit a narrative that keeps certain hierarchies in place?
Right.
That is just food for thought. I'm not going to tell you what conclusion to come to. These are our thoughts and feelings, but I think it's important to at least look at critically.
Right. Especially when you think about the addition, and when you add on to that, which we'll talk about in a moment, when you add on to that, the religious factor and what the Bible says, and Christians, you know, how it colors, how societal constructs color our interpretations of the Bible. The interpretations of primarily men who interpreted the Bible, who also, you know, wrote all of the books and like old literature on, what is it called? Like commentaries on the Bible, which is where we get a lot of our theology from too. So how were they being influenced by social constructs as well to interpret the Bible in the specific way that that many people interpret it now is really interesting.
Well, I cannot wait to get into that. I would love to start off though by examining how traditional gender roles are constructed and enforced through socialization processes like media representations and institutional norms. And, you know, when I think of that, I think you mentioned some of them in your own experience, right? There are common sayings and phrases, whether consciously or unconsciously, perpetuate discrimination and reinforce stigma and patriarchal attitudes against women. And so some that came to my mind include things like boys will be boys, right? That saying often excuses or minimizes inappropriate behaviors by boys or men, suggesting that certain behaviors like aggression or insensitivity are natural and inevitable aspects of masculinity. Boys being raised to be brave while girls are being raised to be careful, you know? Boys are kind of more raised to be uninhibited while girls are more raised to be like self-conscious and to make sure that they are, you know, fitting into society and are very conscious of that. The idea that you're being too emotional or don't be so sensitive, right? These phrases dismiss women's emotions and reinforce the idea that expressing feelings is a sign of weakness or inferiority. And they contribute to the marginalization of women's voices and experiences by invalidating their experiences and reinforcing stereotypes about women's irrationality. But they also mute the spectrum of men's emotions and internal processes and experiences. And this is why men have so many unreported mental health issues and different things. And things just come out sideways in their relationships because they're not allowed the space and room to express themselves in certain ways because of patriarchal attitudes. Other kind of sayings, like you kind of said, Ranella, like the idea that no man will want an outspoken woman, or that women talk too much, if she's like expressing her opinions. This is one I just like grinds my gears. It's the idea that women make emotional decisions and men are more logical. Making men's approach naturally more superior, like men have what it takes to get it done. But it's like that could also lead to indiscriminate violence and harm if you're not being thoughtful or you're being inhumane. So yeah, just ideas that women should always look, behave, sound, show up a certain way that put restrictions on women about how they should behave, dress, and present themselves, and reinforce that there's a correct way for women to behave based on traditional notions that kind of deviate from these constructions. So these are all examples that came up for me that unconsciously or consciously perpetuate these narratives, maybe without us even realizing it, or maybe we ourselves have actually internalized some of these ideas.
Absolutely. And I think I like how you also highlighted the constraints that it puts on men as well. And the ideas that they have to grow up with in what it means to be masculine. And I think, as much as we get the pressure to be feminine, I think men are under this kind of constant surveillance of themselves and others if they're being masculine enough. And I think that that is a whole journey for men to go through as well, that they're still like just now learning how to navigate and put language to, because essentially, because of this very toxic narrative of how women are inferior and weaker, I believe that within toxic masculinity, almost the antithesis of being a man is being a weak woman. Like if you are a,
That's the worst
if
thing.
you're not, yeah, if you're not, you're not a man, it's because you're a sissy, or your other words, or you are, too girly, or like, boys don't cry, only girls do. And it's almost, as if society in general, within the realm of patriarchy and toxic masculinity, has learned to essentially hate women because it is the, like that is everything they need to not be in order to truly be a man. And so it's this polarization of the masculine and feminine. And of course, in, the last 20 to 50 years, when this idea of, encompassing both male and female traits, masculine and feminine traits, that people are on a spectrum in both,
It's not gender based.
Like that has been so difficult, I think, for men, because for them, what they're told is that to be feminine is to not be a man. Whereas, I love like when men become empowered in their healthy masculinity, and they're able to kind of know their identity is not in their masculinity, but in who they are, and that they have the freedom to have preferences, to have a gender identity and healthy sexuality that is not based on oppressing women, so that they do have permission to be able to cry when they need to cry, to be vulnerable when they feel vulnerable, and to say things like, yeah, this is really hurtful to me right now, actually. This is hard for me. I want to cry without feeling so like feminine that they it demascul like they're not masculine anymore. And I think that blend is just so beautiful, because it just shows that identity is not based on your gender and your gender identity. It's really based on so much more. And so I just to highlight the fact that women have all these massive pressures put on them because of the effects of patriarchy, but so do men. It is not good for either side. It puts both of them in boxes that don't allow them to actually express the full range of emotions and humanity that lives inside of them.
That's the problem, is that it dichotomizes people, right? And it's like it's nothing wrong if you want to be feminine or like I love being feminine, like, you know, as a woman, and I'm very attracted to masculinity, you know, to healthy masculinity. And that's just like what I love, right? But there's a spectrum, you know, it doesn't mean that like I only have to like feminine things or, you know, what have you. And I think for me, I'm grateful because I feel like I grew up with a father who was a little bit more androgynous, who had a little bit more of both traits. And we
Same,
didn't
actually.
really, okay, yeah, because we didn't have, I didn't grow up with like seeing my parents in traditional gender roles. My mom worked a lot. And then at one point, my dad was, they agreed, like my mom would work, she was a nurse, and my dad was in the ministry. So he helped work for the ministry and he didn't make as much. My mom was the breadwinner. But so my dad stayed home with me more. Like he was the one that was more of like the nurturer at home. He also was the one who was more actually attuned to his emotions and expressing his emotions. I've seen my dad shed tears and cry like my entire life. When something moves him, he wears his emotions like on his sleeve, but he also has like self-control, you know, and he also has. He's also masculine. He's also dominant. He where he's, you know, where he needs to like put his foot down on things, right? So like for me, I'm really grateful because I feel like I saw a healthy like spectrum of just like expression in a man through my father. And so but I saw like yeah, in other places in the world where maybe these things were muted or shut down. But for me, that was an example that, oh no, like this is not black or white. You can be masculine, but you can also be nurturing. You can also be relational. You can also be caretaking. You can also be affectionate. Like all these things that are ascribed to like men or women is just like actually we tend to gravitate toward people who carry all of these traits because they tend to be more well-rounded, and those tend to be really great leaders. So I actually want to like kind of advocate the alternative narrative that the more androgynous a person actually is, the more you know, comprehensiveness they have, and those are great qualities for leadership.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because we're all shaped by our environment and what we witnessed growing up. And so that for some, you know, like us, my dad was also in the kitchen a lot. And he, you know, like he's kind of the artsy, like artistic, emotional one.
Yeah, I
And
love that.
yeah, so for us, like we grew up with that example, but for some people, they might have grown up where like the roles were really clear, or they might even heard their, you know, maybe have never seen their father's cry, or you know, have never witnessed any of that. And I think that can definitely be a little bit harder. And I don't know if there's necessarily a correct you know, kind of box for everyone to fit in, but mainly like it's a process of self-discovery. And especially if you are a heterosexual male, you know, a process of education and awareness, especially if you're trying to marry a heterosexual female, you know, like you, that's you have to go through that process of becoming aware and understanding, and maybe even allowing yourself to be exposed to that more of that androgynous experience and what it might look like to adopt more qualities that you've always felt were feminine but are actually just human.
Yeah, and are actually just true to you. So I
Exactly.
think shifting here into, you know, the relationship between religion and patriarchy, and I know we have some experiences with that because I mean, this overlaps with religion, it overlaps with familial upbringing, it overlaps with politics, with like so many things. And I definitely recommend listening to the episode that Ranella did with Stephanie on purity culture, because they definitely expound a lot on that there. But I think for me, kind of going back to what you said, Ranella, which is also my perspective, and that's that, you know, scripture was written during a time of patriarchy, you know, and so the writings reflect that cultural history and perspective, much like anything else that was written at that time, right? So I'm just gonna say, like, slavery was culturally acceptable at that time. Polygamy was
Mm-hmm.
culturally acceptable. Genocidal warfare was culturally acceptable. You know, violence against women and children to overtake. We saw this happen in Jericho, right? We like to say, oh,
Right.
Jericho was a victory, but we leave out that it was also kind of a genocide. Like, and or even like head coverings, right? Which head coverings are totally fine today, but a lot of people who read the Bible actually don't still ascribe to head coverings as a sign of purity,
Right.
you know, in the Christian world. So I say all that to say, like, it's not uncommon for us to see things that are taken place or that are prescriptive, I think, in scripture that are reflecting the cultural norms of that time. I think it's difficult for me when we pick and choose which one of those are still relevant and which one of those aren't,
Right.
when we can look at some and clearly say, okay, that was unethical and that was harmful. We no longer ascribe to that, even though we saw that this was the societal structure of that time, right? We did
Right.
that with slavery. So why
Yeah.
not patriarchy, right? Is what I'm thinking. And so,
And just
again, when
to
we're thinking
tag
about so,
on,
go ahead.
oh, sorry, not to interrupt you, but like, it's just so interesting because when you say all of this, I came from a subculture, a denomination that basically staked their whole theology and their whole existence, their whole identity on this idea of the Bible and the Bible only, and that their interpretation was like could not be disputed. And if you go outside of that interpretation, then you're in like now you're in the world of like no absolutes and anything goes. It's almost
Right.
like a very black and white way of thinking, like, oh, if you start breaking down this one part of your biblical interpretation, then who's to say that anyone's interpretation can be valid? And all of a sudden there's no footing for your, you know, there's no ground for your footing. Like you're just like,
Right.
it's very threatening. So actually to even
Yes. Yes.
question the validity of a scripture that says something and say, oh, well, that might have been socially constructed, like that would kind of break down everything. And so I'm just highlighting that for the people who, you know, have been
Yes.
kind of put in a corner by this type of theology and way of thinking of sacred texts, that, you know, these certain interpretations are infallible. I think that if you come from that perspective, then it will be very difficult to deconstruct many things that don't sit well with you in the Bible, and yet still try to hold on to a semblance of faith. Like, and I just, you know, for me, it's just so important to kind of have like a very broad, open mind when it comes to things that I just don't know about. You know, I wasn't there when the scripture was written. I wasn't there when the events happened. And so there is room, but it's just so interesting when you say that because I think I know how some people would
Yeah.
feel and react
Yes.
to those statements.
Yeah, I think when one idea that's such a core idea and you begin to pull the string and it kind of unravels, there is that fear of like what else could unravel.
Right,
And I
exactly.
think for me, it's just like, I don't know. For me, again, core issues of just love and for humans means that anything that's just unethical and that harms people also aligns with my values that I think are
Right.
biblical. And I don't think it's actually about the scripture not being sacred, but it's about, again, the social constructions around maybe scripture or only one narrative of it that's being perpetuated when there are other narratives that are equally biblical and equally scripture based. It's just about how it's constructed to us, you
Right.
know. So I completely hear you on that because that was a journey I had to go through myself. And I realized that these kind of issues only come up when we're trying to make the Bible something it was not meant to be, or we're trying to, you know, or we do take it out of like cultural context, right? If the logic of it can break down so easily, you know, then
Right.
maybe there's a problem with the structural view if it's not lining up with the spirit of the word or the character and heart of God. Maybe it's actually the structure of the view rather than, you right. know, God or, you know, anyway, so all that to say, again, going back to the idea of things being socially constructed, you know, I also think about some of the leading voices in the history of some of our Western views of religion, specifically the Christian religion. I think of Saint Augustine, who was a bishop, theologian, and philosopher of antiquity, whose thoughts profoundly influenced the medieval world that carried forward. You know, he wrote that, "I don't see what sort of help a woman was created to provide man if one excludes the purpose of procreation. If a woman was not given to a man for help in bearing children, what help could she be?" Right? So basically this idea that like there is no use for a woman other outside. Than her service to a man in procreation. And this is a leading voice of Western theology. And that has been shaped. And again, religious teachings and doctrines have been interpreted through patriarchal lenses, leading to the justification and perpetuation of gender-based inequalities, you know? So yeah, it doesn't come out of nowhere.
No. And the fact that, you know, I mean, even in the church that I still consider myself a member of today, I mean, when you look at their leadership structure, they definitely reinforce traditional gender roles. There are no women in the highest forms of leadership, and women pastors are still looked down upon and not taken as seriously, and kind of, you know, people kind of scratch their heads at how a woman could be a pastor, you know, based on all these scriptures that says that the you know, he should be a pastor, the pastor should be a husband of one wife, so how could a woman be a pastor? You know, it's just like these conundrums that people find themselves conundrums, like how could it be possible? So yeah, it's just so interesting because they reinforce that, and obviously not just in religious roles, but in general in society, there's always that people scratching their head, how can she go to work and be a wife and a mother? And, you know, like, obviously everyone is allowed to do whatever the heck they want and figure that out, you know, based on what their family values are, but, and what they've decided in whatever season of life they're in. But for, as a society, we still, you know, scratch our heads sometimes, especially men scratch their heads as to how that's possible. But you see that in church as well. And that says something. When you don't put people in leadership, you're sending a message. And there was at one point I thought I was going to be a pastor, actually. Like, there literally was a point where I thought I was going to go to seminary, I was going to be a woman pastor. But I looked around and I just could hardly see any women. I saw the way they were treated. And I also just thought to myself, like, I, you know, obviously that was not my calling, but it really did discourage me because I just looked around and I was like, oh no, I don't want to be kind of in this type of system where it is like pulling teeth to try to get people to take you seriously as a woman.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And when I see kind of the war on this dialogue about women in leadership and women in pastors, because I read so many things without even saying anything. What I see a lot of people doing is proof texting, which is they're like pulling different scriptures, going back and forth with different scriptures, and they can both find scriptures to support their views, right? So like I don't really get into those debates because you could go all day once you start proof texting things.
Yeah.
So, you know, to support your idea. So, you know, I'm grateful that like the home church that I kind of grew up in, they had the lead, pastors who were husband and wife. They would alternate teaching, and then sometimes they would have other, you know, leaders, both men and women teaching, and our leadership hierarchy was also gender diverse. So for me, I actually had an initial experience of seeing both the strengths of men and women in leadership, and I admired them both. And so I'm really grateful, because as I went further into the world and realized that these were barriers and obstacles in other traditions, I was like, oh, okay, this is like serious. That was something I actually was exposed to later on. But
Right.
yeah, so gosh, we're just gonna take a quick deep breath.
No, this is, I just, I
Because there's
love
a
all the
lot
information.
of
Yeah. Like,
information. There's a lot to digest. You know, I definitely
right.
highly recommend re-listening to this. We will list in the show notes, you know, just resources and all the things. But I think we wanted to switch now into kind of like advocacy, empowerment, and healing, and what that could look like in the context of therapy, you know, in a mental health context. And you know, addressing the mental health impacts of patriarchy re really requires a multifaceted approach that involves challenging some of these gender narratives in people's lives and systemic inequalities and providing accessible, you know, mental health services that support and value and empower women and marginalized communities. So that could look like validating women's experiences within patriarchal systems, acknowledging the impact of sexism, misogyny, and gender-based violence on their mental health and well-being. By affirming the validity of their experiences, therapists can help women feel seen, heard, and understood. I think that's so important as a therapist, as someone in mental health, to acknowledge that, yeah, there's probably some things going on internally for sure, but also you're living in a system that also might be internalizing some narratives that are making it difficult for you to fully live in agency and autonomy and, in your full potential, and that stifling and that suppression could be playing a role in some of this internalized stress, anxiety, and depression. Maybe you've been stuck in roles that are kind of draining you or robbing you of life or suppressing you, and you really just need to be liberated. And like therapy can kind of help with some of those narratives.
Yes, absolutely. And I love this whole topic of women's empowerment because it is allowing women to become autonomous in the way that they view themselves. And a lot of times that takes that deconstructing of the narratives and the beliefs. And a lot of times that can happen in relationships. And so we talk about internalizing sexism and self-doubt. I think that that is such a real experience if you're a woman and you're, you've been in a relationship with a heterosexual male. You've probably experienced feeling very invalidated by your feelings, depending on, again, there are some really incredible men out there,
For
heterosexual
sure.
men, who are, for whatever reason, saw it modeled by their parents and their fathers and their moms to be more emotionally aware and available and forward-facing when it comes to relationships. But there are a lot of men that have never been given those skills and those strategies. And so as a woman, you do have to take, kind of measures for yourself to protect your own heart and emotions to be able and willing to stand up for yourself and say, hey, like this is my subjective experiences are not up for debate, but I am sharing them because I care and I'm looking for spaces where I feel safe to be myself and to be understood and to find whatever solutions I need to find in my own time. And that can be really hard to have that courage and the bravery to say that and to not feel like you're going to be automatically rejected. I think there's a way to be respectful and kind and very, very open and firm. And I think probably if you are in that space where you feel that everything I just shared resonates with you probably need to hold out for a man who has had some experience with an understanding of, deconstructing patriarchy and understanding his own privilege and things like that, because then there's the language and there's the understanding, or at least someone who's willing to learn.
Yeah, or kind of naturally has that bend toward a more egalitarian, like,
Right.
relationship. So I love what you're saying. That could look like, helping women develop coping strategies, assertiveness skills, and self-care practices that will help promote resilience and empowerment. Also, yeah, helping women reflect on traditional gender roles and expectations and how these have influenced their beliefs and behaviors and relationships so that they can foster greater authenticity and self-acceptance, as well as helping women connect with supportive networks and community resources that help foster a sense of solidarity and belonging and resilience in the face of systemic injustice. So there are definitely ways that everything we're talking about can be incorporated in a therapeutic way and should be acknowledged, because, mental health doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's also impacted by cultures and systems and narratives. And this is one of many, that intersect the lives of definitely both men and women, but especially can affect women in a very, very detrimental way that sometimes aren't even recognized because they're internalized beliefs and ideologies. So it's important to kind of talk through what some of those narratives are and are they really serving her?
Yeah,
So,
absolutely.
I mean, really quickly, I just had a text conversation with a girlfriend who was just had been feeling really depressed lately about her life, felt like nothing was working. And then the moment she started being more assertive, like with her family, with her husband, about the boundaries she needed, the breaks she needed, the time she needed, I could just visibly see she was happier, freer, wholer. And it was because she was able to kind of break out of some of these roles and norms and reclaim herself.
Love that.
And it directly affected her mental health and well-being. So this is what I'm talking about.
Oh, I love that. When women are empowered, I really do believe communities are empowered because women are the nurture. We are the ones raising children at home still. A lot of women still, it's a huge percentage of women that kind of bear that, the main brunt of that. And so they're the ones that are also teaching their young sons and daughters. And I think when women can have that sense of empowerment in their relationships to speak up for themselves, and I think that's just such a healing, beautiful thing. And one of the ways that you can do that is, after you're done listening to this, try to find some time by yourself and take some time to write it out, journal out, like, what does it really feel like to be respected by the men in your life, by your husband, by your family? What does it mean to have self-care for you? Like, what would be ideal for you? What would it look like for you to be happy? I think women can really trust their gut instincts when it comes to what will actually make them happy. And we just don't sit down and have quiet time and slow time enough to actually ask ourselves that important question, because when you gain clarity on that, then you, and when you have hopefully the permission to vocalize those things and to start making, finding solutions, that's when things can change. But it really does start with you finding the clarity, accepting what you find, and being willing to talk about it, and trust that the people who really love you will respect what you have to share. So
Amen.
again,
That's so
we
good.
definitely are coming from a women's perspective. Men, there are so many resources out there to understand more about the effects of patriarchy on you and on the women on your life. And I just really encourage you, if you are a heterosexual male trying to navigate this world and date and, get married, that will only make your relationships that much better, and hopefully your relationship with
Yes.
yourself.
Oh, so good. Amen. Thank you guys so much for taking the time to unpack this with us. Again, be sure to follow along with us online on social media to continue the conversation. And we love hearing from you. Until next time.
Hey, if you enjoyed today's episode, let's continue the conversation and stay connected on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube, all linked in the show notes below. Let us know your thoughts or leave a review on the podcast. Your feedback really does mean so much to us. Until next time.